Blog Talk Radio.
I'm just waiting on see if she enters the call.
Hello.
So this is Chris from Voice of Bellin Radio, and ladies and gentlemen, we have brought Ms. McKinney onto the line, and now she is joining us here at UCY.TV. I'm very honored to have you as a guest here, and I must say I'm very taken back by the opportunity to interview. You've been one of the people that I've wanted to interview for a decent amount of time now, and you know, one of the first questions that's going to come to mind is that, you know, you're probably one of the highest ranking former government officials, you know, by being a former congresswoman, to have spoken out about the things that you've spoken about, you know, talking about and all this kind of stuff. And here's the one question that comes to mind is that, you know, I think people probably might have asked it before, but, you know, it feels like I would wake up every morning, I'd look both ways before doing everything, you know. Do you feel like you've taken any kind of, like, heat besides, you know, just, like, media attention? But I'm talking about, like, do you think there's been any kind of a harassment by the powers that be for what you do?
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, it's sort of like, let me count the ways. First of all, I had two stalkers that I ended up filing police reports against. This is all political. I wish it was about love, but it wasn't. And so I had that situation, and before that situation, I was literally stalked. Okay, but I didn't report that, but I'm thinking about that. Oh my gosh. I remember my chief of staff and I were in some place in D.C. that was very crowded, and all of a sudden, my chief of staff says, I think we're being followed. And so we eventually made it back to the office, the congressional office. It was the Cannon House office building. And my office was on the corner, or I should say the people's office was that I that I had was on the corner. And so my chief of staff went into the men's room, and there was this same guy in the men's room listening to what was going on in the congressional office. He caught him. So anyway, that's one of those stories that I haven't ever told. You just made me think about it. But that was definitely
crazy. It just came to mind because, you know, I've heard of stories of people, you know, that were in some kind of level of power, and then they end up speaking out about either, you know, the, you know, corrupt practices. You know, we've had several, you know, if you can think about over the years, where people have ended up, you know, mysteriously disappearing or, you know, mysteriously being killed, you know, or in a higher ranking. And I wonder, you, the congresswoman, you know, that at one point, I feel like there'd definitely be that, at least one of those stories of that kind of nature, where at least with some kind of harassment. Because, you know, to say the least, I would say that you definitely have spoken quite a bit. And, you know, I've seen some media stories that tried to lump us all together nowadays. And now they try to lump everybody. Now I've heard people try to call you the alt-left. That's the term they tried to staple to you recently. I think the Washington Post or something like that. It was some media article I was reading recently about you. And I was like, alt-left? Yeah. That's kind of an interesting term. You know, it's kind of like trying to say that you're the that we're the people like us. Because I would say that I'm also, I guess I could say, on the left, but not the mainstream left, not the, you know, the left that's being pushed by on the media right now, but, you know, which I don't even consider to be the real left. I consider just to be the oligarchy, Democrat, Republican, but...
yes.
But they call you alt-left. It makes, it lumps us all into, like, alt-left, alt-right, which they, you know, they've tried, they pretty much, you know, told us that, yeah, the people that oppose... the mainstream are, you know, some kind of element of the fringe of society, that we are the undesirables almost of a modern society, and they, you know, the deplorables almost, if you will, is that
right.
If you oppose this idea that you know, of right now, one of the biggest things that they're pushing the media heavily, and it's like, if you are an opponent of it, then you must be either some way collusive if you are a politician, or if you're a regular person, then you must have bigoted views of some kind, you know, that if you don't support this idea that the Russian government somehow meddled in our election in 2016,
right,
is the biggest, you know, boogeyman's series out there. And, you know, and ultimately, you as a former third-party candidate should ultimately know that if the ultimate meddling that happens in the election happens by big money candidate, by the big money lobbies, the Israel lobby, and so far. And I want to hear just a little bit more about, because you ran, I wasn't sure about this. I believe I saw you ran twice, right, in 04 and 08 for the Green Party?
I ran, I ran in 08 for the Green Party. We considered it in 04, but I ran for election to Congress in 04.
Okay, yes, that's what I read. Okay, so yeah, you did run for president in 08, and
right.
Which I wonder, considering all things aside, that ultimately this system seems to, it's Democrat versus Republican every time. I wonder, I just want to hear from a candidate that took it this far. I know it's not anywhere near easy process, even if you are not really if you're on a third party candidate, that chances of winning are small. There's still a very difficult process to go about running for president.
Sure.
Everything, the ballot, signatures, yeah, and everything. What was your main reason for running in 2008?
Well, I guess you could say that it's a kind of a generational thing. If you analyze where I was politically at that time, because my family were Democrats, and that was, you know, what we were. But what happened was that the Democratic Party, as I knew it back then, moved away from my values, and the Democratic Party became another part of the war machine, which, of course, I opposed vehemently. Therefore, that was the impetus for me, served as the impetus for me to run not as a Democrat, because the Democrats were complicit, had proven themselves, demonstrated that they were complicit in all of the wars, the war crimes, the torture, you name it, those violations of civil rights, civil liberties. That was Democratic Party policy.
Yes, definitely. That has been it seems as the years went on, the theme has gone that the Republicans and Democrats, the little differences that may have existed have definitely been erased. And now you see nowadays where you have it's gotten all blurred. I mean, you look at this 2016 election, and that's the perfect example. It doesn't matter anymore. Is that Hillary, a former Republican, running as Democrat? You have Trump, a former Democrat, running as a Republican. People switch their views. And ultimately, in the end, we end up with two terrible candidates that nobody wanted. We have the ultimate queen of corruption, Hillary Clinton, versus the, I guess you could say, the typical land development liar, you know, just a typical man. I mean, only difference, I guess, that you could say between Hillary and Trump was that Hillary didn't like to admit she lied. Trump pretty much admits his whole MO. If you look at the art of the deal, he pretty much admits what he's about. He'll lie to get what he needs to. I mean, this is something that he's admitted before, and he really is not ashamed of. You know, I guess in a way you could say that the one positive maybe about the Trump presidency is that the ugly mask, the mask over the ugly war machine, the whatever you want to call it, the powers that be, the military industrial complex behind D.C. is finally being unraveled and shown, partially by just Trump's wild card mentality that he's inadvertently exposing some truths that are, you know, about D.C., about the just corrupt nature of it. And, you know, you were in Congress
but that's very important, what you just said. It's extremely important. When it's very clear, when it becomes very clear exactly what is happening, what's going on, who's pulling the strings, and what those strings are, and who those strings benefit, that's incredibly important. So, you know, even though I'm not satisfied to say that thank goodness Hillary isn't president, but I'm happy to be able to say that. And at the same time, I'm not happy with the things that are coming out, but these are exactly the things that I have been saying for, I looked at my calendar and I started talking about the pernicious influences that were affecting U.S. policy in 1993. So it's 20, actually it was 92, because that was the year I ran for Congress. 93 was when I got sworn in. And then, since 92, since the campaign. And it has taken this long, you could say 25 years, for people to catch up with me where I was. Now, that's totally unacceptable to me. But at least, thank goodness, it has come. And so now eyes are being opened in a way, because Trump is the president, that I don't believe would have been opened without him being president. So he campaigned on fake news. Well, some of us knew that the news was quote-unquote news, mainstream media, lamestream media, corporate media, whatever you want to call it, was skewed and not telling the truth, was a propaganda tool of the deep state. Well, I knew that from reading the COINTELPRO papers. But how many people have bothered to read the COINTELPRO papers to understand exactly what the U.S. government is capable of doing, not only to other people around the world, but also to its own people? Because what the U.S. government, what we learned from the Frank Church Intelligence Committee reports is that the activities that the U.S. engages in abroad, it always brings back home. So the U.S. people will eventually suffer if they allow it to happen in somebody else's neighborhood in other countries, and that is exactly what the people of the U.S. have allowed. So now it's on the verge, well, actually it's not even on the verge, it is actually coming back home, and I guess we could say, as Malcolm X said, chickens coming home to roost. Now it's very clear. And Trump talked about the fake news, Trump talked about the system being rigged, Trump was the one that talked about the needlessness for these wars, although he hasn't done anything to stop them. But at least during, we got a campaign that at least broached those subjects. In 2008, neither candidate broached the subject of the wars, of the U.S. war machine. In 2012, the same thing happened. In 2016, we finally got a real conversation going about some of the things that really concern the people of the United States and definitely concern me, and that is U.S. conduct abroad.
Well, I'll talk about U.S. conduct abroad. The unfortunate reality, though, is despite Trump having talked about the needlessness of the wars, like you said, we're still currently engaged in many activities in the Middle East, and there's been no pulling back. And unfortunately, do you think that Trump, I believe that Trump is been fanning the flames of the potential strike in maybe in Iran? And I've been predicting for a long time that the United States would eventually strike Iran around this time in the later half of this decade. There'd probably be some kind of military confrontation with Iran. And I just go partially on the hunch that I think Trump could do it because of his strong connection to the Israeli government. You know, what do you think about all that? Is that, you know, that's the meddling they never talk about, you know, the influence they never talk about on the media is Israel's involvement in the Trump administration between Jared Kushner and all the and also the ties that Trump himself has directly. I mean, this is maybe, as he said, he's one of the most pro-Zionist presidents that's ever taken office. What do you think about all that?
Well, it was in 1992 that I first became aware of and then spoke out about the demands that the pro-Israel lobby make on the candidates for Congress. And of course, I was called every name under the book, thrown under the bus. Nobody believed. I was, vilified in every possible way. But the fact still remains that that is the case. And now it has become painfully clear to people in the United States that thought that their members of Congress actually controlled policy, and that their president and that their judiciary actually was concerned about the U.S. Constitution. Now they find out otherwise. And in some cases, it's shocking, it's painful for some people to admit that they've been tricked, fooled, hoodwinked, bamboozled by a government that they actually believed in. I remember I was in Texas, the electrocution capital of the U.S., and I was outside an electrocution. I was outside the prison where it was going to happen. And this was a white man who was about to be killed. His family was out there. They were crying. And so I just asked them, I said, did you ever in your wildest dreams think that you would be here? And they said, no, we believed in the system. And how many people have spent their whole lives believing in a system that was rigged and so totally unworthy of their respect and support? So at least now, the last fig leaf has been removed as a result of Trump. When Trump first announced, I wanted to know who he was. And I looked on Wikipedia, found his Trump companies, then looked at who signed the check, because, of course, you know, that's the most important position in any company, is not who's the front person. And then when I saw who signed the checks, I said, okay, that tells me all I need to know. However, what that meant for me was that there was this knowledge in the back of my head, maybe in the depths of my heart that even though these things were being talked about in a campaign that had never been talked about before in this way by a mainstream party, a major party candidate, that we could end up where we are. But it was so important for me that we not end up with President Hillary. And so I wrote, I think I wrote every week, I wrote an article about Hillary's past and what her policies were. I focused in on Haiti because Haiti was just so patently clear. And if she didn't respect democracy in Haiti, the way she went down there, she sent Cheryl Mills down there, and Cheryl Mills read out in the first place, I want to know, well, why is Cheryl Mills reading out the winner of the election? But Cheryl Mills goes down there and reads out the wrong winner to the election, and everybody in the room is stunned. The chairman of the Presidential Election Commission for Haiti says that he was shocked and he was quite frankly afraid to say anything. But Cheryl Mills read out the wrong result, and Haiti was strapped for 5 years, which is their term of office for the president, with someone that they didn't vote for, that the people didn't support. And Hillary's brother ends up with a gold mine at the end of it. Israel ends up with a border security contract. You can imagine that. And friends of Bill, who had made tremendous contributions to the Clinton Foundation, ended up with contracts utilizing the poor Haitians' money. So that was all I needed to know for evidence to know that this kind of conduct should never be rewarded with the highest office in the U.S. And then, of course, not even to mention what was going on with Libya. So things were pretty clear for me that the greatest danger was the danger of a Hillary Clinton presidency. And I would continue to say that because the fig leaf would still be on. And now we can say that with the Jerusalem decision, for example, that was always U.S. law. He just said, okay, I'm going to recognize the law. And if there's an onus, put the onus back on the members of Congress that voted for the law. Well, I have something to admit. I'm one of those who voted for that law. And I have to be honest, I did exactly what my colleagues do. I ran into the chamber of the House at the last minute, saw that every button up there was green, so I pressed the green button and it was that bill. I said, I will never do that again. That's what ended up getting me kicked out of Congress, because I decided at that point I got kicked out twice. And I decided at that point that I was going to read every bill, know what I was voting on, that I was going to speak out against the things that were wrong. And I made a commitment to the Palestinians. There was a protest that night that the bill passed. And a man died, a 78-year-old man died, and he was throwing stones at the U.S. consulate. And I took personal responsibility for that death. He had a heart attack. And I said, I will never, through my carelessness, I will never be responsible again for that kind of death. And that I knew that I wanted to be anti-war, that just solidified everything. And so I made my mea culpas. I went to various organizations. I apologized. I acknowledged what I did. I accepted responsibility for my role in it, even though if I had voted no, it would have been one vote. But still, that's not the point. The point is that I was complicit in an act that I disagreed with. And so therein began my journey, and which is why when September 11th happened, I was compelled to speak out. I was compelled to get to the bottom of things because ultimately I'm a researcher anyway. And what we were being given from the Bush administration in terms of the official narrative of what happened just was totally insufficient as an elected official for me to go back and tell my constituents that we were hit because we were free. In the first place, I understand that we weren't free. And so, therefore, I couldn't go back and say, okay, you know, they're really jealous of our freedoms. But if you recall, that was the official narrative, and that's what President Bush told us to do. And so when I bucked that, that was when the wrath of the pro-Israel lobby came down. And then when I traveled over to Paris, I was actually in Paris at the time of the announcement of President Obama's receipt of the Nobel Peace Prize. And I thought it was a joke. I couldn't believe it was true. Well,
yeah,
anyway.
Like, oh, nine, only a month after he'd even been elected. He hadn't even done anything practically. They gave him the Nobel Peace Prize.
Right. And so I was in Paris participating in a 9-1-1 truth event. And the thing that struck me more than anything else was that those people who wanted to have a rational explanation of what happened and how the $1 trillion infrastructure, military and intelligence infrastructure, failed four times on one day, of course, that still has not been explained. The interesting thing over in Europe was that anyone who wanted to know the truth and wanted to was calling for an investigation, just calling for an investigation, was called anti-Semitic. Now, anti-Semitic didn't have anything to do with what happened on 9-1-1. Well, of course, once you started digging, what you learned is that Israel was intimately involved with the events of September 11th. And so one can in no way understand what happened on September 11th without also understanding that there was something going on with Israel. And that is why there's been so much, it's almost like gatekeeping on the left, that anti-war organizations would refuse to discuss September 11th. And almost to this day, and you get people who are presumed to, you've got people who are presumed to be, you know, anti-war, and yet, when you ask them about September 11th, say, oh, we don't need to talk about that. And those people are protecting somebody.
Yes. So, you know, when you get onto the whole topic of 9-11 and Israel's collusion, it's something that I found out about the 9/11, the all the inconsistencies at a pretty early age. And I didn't realize, though, until much later about Israel's involvement. And, you know, we see all these very striking coincidences, like the urban movement systems in their mural van that was going around New York City that day, the dancing Israeli, the, you know, the sixth, what was the guy that was on the George Washington Bridge? I think it was still something like six Israelis were arrested in New York City that day. And the guy that was on the George Washington with a van full of bombs and then was released like 2 days later back to Israel. I don't know if it was 2 days, but I know he was released back in a very short time. And when we look at this, and this is a something that is not just, it's a pattern. It's not just a one event where we realize that Israel's relationship with America is we give them so much money every year, and what we get in return, there's no angle that can just that can the Israeli relationship with America can be justified. When you look at what they've done at the USS Liberty, I've interviewed some of the survivors of that, and you know, practically every survivor that ship on that ship pretty much says yes, it was an Israeli false flag to try to draw into a war. You know what they did in the Levant affair in Egypt because we got relationships with Gamal Nasser at the time. Eisenhower and Nasser were getting along too well for Israel's like, so they tore that relationship apart via false flag. Israel's relationship with America has been one of, you know, I would say that Israel is not the ultimate head of the beast, but they are a little bit further up the ladder, is how I see it, and closer to the people that really are pulling strings in Western world affairs. You know, and 9/11 has been one of those events that's changed not just the way that the military's ran, it's changed the way that our entire society lives. Now it's a society that lives in fear and is constantly looking at the next terrorist attack, constantly fearing that we are attacked by people all around the world. And Israel gets to act like the abusive boyfriend in this entire situation, or that it's going to protect America from everybody else, and we can only trust Israel. Israel is the only one that we can trust in the world, is how they push it to us, and everybody else is out to get us in one way or another. You know, it's like right now we all these boogeymen that they're perpetuating is Russia, ISIS, North Korea. How many times have I heard North Korea over the last few months? All these Qaeda, different, you know, Arabic names. You just put different Arabic words, call it terrorist group, and people believe it. It's like yes, falafel. Yeah, it's a new terrorist group in out of Jordan. It's very scary. You can literally throw any Arabic name and put it on the mainstream media, and you know, just throw out different Arabic words, mash them together, maybe take out a syllable. You got your brand new terrorist group that you can scare people with for 3 years. And 9/11 was the start of all that. And you know, you called out, you were one of the few people. I mean, I don't know if there was anybody else actually in DC at that level that was calling out 9/11 for what it was, and you know, at least questioning. Very few people that rank. I mean, the only people that I could think of that were, you know, in the government at that time that questioned it to the extent maybe was not D.C., but in Minnesota, we had Governor Ventura that was one of the few other people that was calling out some of the dirty deeds of deep state at the time. But, you know, you got a lot of flack from it for sure. And about 9/11 truths. And here's my question is that, in your opinion, how sure are you that do you think this is an inside job? Do you think this is some kind of thing that the that Bush allowed the attacks to happen? Or would you say that I am under the assumption that it was an inside and an outside job, but not an outside job by Al-Qaeda, but I believe an outside job by Mossad and the Saudi Arabian government. What is your stance on that?
Well, it would be impossible to pull off something like that without having inside knowledge. Now, what we do know about the U.S. deep state is that the composition of the U.S. deep state has changed. There was a time, I call it the Zio-cons versus the pilgrims. So there was a point at which I would go around and I would ask white men, I said, this used to be your country. Now it's not your country. How did you lose the United States without a shot being fired? And now you're like strangers in your own land. Well, it's not your land, but I mean strangers in the land. And so this was my line of questioning. I did this for about a year just to gain an understanding, because it was clear to me that the pilgrims were no longer in control of the country. And what I was told by one respondent really stuck out with me, and that is, Cynthia, they're white, just like us. And, you know, Netanyahu's wife said that the Israelis were sophisticated Europeans. That's her quote. So I think that they use their skin color in a way to advantage themselves. And then after they got what they want, which is control of the U.S., then they chucked their they're not compatriots, but they're colluders, chuck them aside. And so basically now what you're seeing is the Catherine Austin Fitz always likes to say to me that some of the pilgrims, they chose, because of their greed or whatever, to betray the other pilgrims, and they chose to side with the Zionists. And so, yes, this would not have been able to happen, and I'm talking about now this changing of who occupies the chairs on the deck of the Titanic. That changing, or that set of musical chairs that provided us what we have now, is the division, the deep division. Well, let me go back a minute. So Clinton, in 2016, in my opinion, from my analysis, Clinton represented the Zio-Con as a unit. Trump, in terms of the voters, Trump represented the pilgrims to the voters. So this was an identity thing for some people. Now, what happened, though, is that Trump was able to make that appeal because he himself was propped up by one, what we did not know at the time or didn't realize because we were not from that community, a different faction of the Zio-Con. Like I say, go back to who signs the checks in the Trump business. And so now you've got one faction of Zio-Cons fighting another faction of Zio-Cons to determine who ultimately has their finger on the button. But the place of the pilgrims is over. It's done, in my opinion. And that's why you see this white anger. You've got the shortening of life expectancies. And guess what? You've got now dysfunctional behavior. You've got the opioid crisis. And so now all of a sudden, you've got the same behaviors from that segment of the pilgrims that used to complain about the way black people, Latino people, people of color all behaved. And now, as my former partner at hashtag OnRig used to say, now everybody is black. or as I say, we're all Palestinians now. So the transformation has been it's really something. I need to write about this, but I want to see it unfold a little bit more. I have written about cliometrics. Cliometrics is a theory that is put forward by Peter Turchin, who believes that history can be mapped and analyzed quantitatively. And through this process that he innovated, what he has found is that in boom periods, the deep state of a country will not be able to satisfy the prestige requirements of all of the members who view themselves as part of the deep state. For example, there's only so many members of Congress, there's only so many Supreme Court seats, there's only so many of the senior executive service, those are those plum jobs in Washington, on Capitol Hill, throughout the federal bureaucracy. There's only so many of these people who can be accommodated at a time of boom when they feel that they are deserving. And that begins the process of the split of the deep state. And that's exactly what happened. There was a time, of course, when it was, say, for example, you brought up USS Liberty. And at that time, pilgrims are in control, but the Ziocons are there, and they're hiding in plain sight, and they are also a part of the government. They're not yet in control. But their agenda was to use their ability to maneuver themselves inside your community and then become those in control. And that's exactly what has happened. I watched it as a member of Congress when the Democratic National Committee, the DNC headquarters, switched from basically Irish control to Jewish control. From reliance on Irish money to reliance on Jewish money. And so this is a process that's been going on for a long time. And you know, people don't talk about it because people don't talk about Jews unless they happen to be a Jew. And then if you are a Jew and you talk about Jews, you'd have to be careful or else you become a self-hating Jew. And so, you know, and the process goes on of obfuscating the truth. But now even that fig leaf is gone. And so it's very clear now, this whole process. What is less clear is how, if the ship of state of the United States is going to be regained by we the people, what is the process going to look like? Well, I maintain that this is not a process in which we the people can be divided. And this is very, very important, which is why I hooked up in the hashtag unrig campaign, because part of that unrigging is to unrig ourselves and belief systems that have been built up over centuries, really, that just basically literally are not going to serve us as we try and extricate ourselves from this condition that we're in. Now, I happen to believe that it's going to take all of us, that Black, whites, Jews, Gentiles, Muslims, Christians, Latinos, Mexican Americans, you name it, Puerto Rican American, it's going to take all of us. This is a condition that the pilgrims got into by themselves, but they are not able, in my opinion, to extricate themselves because the other side is too strong.
And it's interesting, you know, how you mentioned, I guess you could say the changeover in America of the people in power. So you look into all the many different positions of power to mainly people of one certain ethnicity, and that would be of a lot of people of Jewish descent. And, you know, it's funny how as soon as you mention that, it's like they've made it ingrained into people's heads that as soon as someone starts mentioning Jewish domination, media and such, that they are officially anything they say is invalid because they're probably some kind of white supremacist or some kind of bigoted person. You know, that's the thing that they have used, especially in recent times, where I get into internet debates with people and, they automatically, because I mentioned how bad the mainstream media is. I didn't even say anything regarding Jewish people altogether. This one guy was saying, I can hear the triple brackets from here, which, if you spend any time on Reddit or really any of the internet nowadays, the triple brackets, that's what a lot of people would do to label Jewish people. It's a whole thing, 4chan. I think that's actually where I was thinking that came from originally. But, we're trying to say it's like everybody's getting lumped into the people that do call out what it really is are getting lumped into the fringe of society, the alt-right. They have many different terms for it, the alt-right or the, extremist. They've really made that term nationalist a really dirty sounding word when that wasn't always a dirty word in American society. And I think that's part of the problem is that they've eroded our American identity and it's been replaced by the internationalist identity. I don't believe in a jingoism and a separatism, where people are people being separated by their, all these labels. But I do believe in the idea of a world of nations. And I think that's one of the things that they've done is they've tried to eliminate in the Western world the borders and such as financial borders, in some ways cultural borders, and try to just make one general, one universal identity in the West. And they're trying to also push that in some of the Eastern countries, but they haven't been as successful as we've seen with what's going on in Russia and I would say China, that they seem to have made their own system of over there. And the international bankers, the IMF, they're a little bit jelly about that. They're not too happy.
Gilad Atman wrote a book entitled Being in Time. And Gilad is a former Israeli who served in the Israeli military, and apparently there are Jewish religious symbols on the bombs that they used to drop on the Palestinians. And so he began to think about that, and he said, well, if this is what it means to be Jewish, then I can't be a Jew any longer. And so he began to write. And what I have, I did a blurb for his first book, which is The Wandering Who. And then his second book, I did the foreword, which is The Being in Time. And basically, The Being in Time book is a very important book because it describes how when everyone breaks down into their, well, when you balkanize the population into your identity cell, then those who are the strongest and the most proficient at identity politics are the ones who will win. And of course, he's talking about the international Jewish community whose aspirations, in some cases, but not in all cases, are represented by the State of Israel. So he writes about this, and this whole process of how these people used what they're good at to destroy everybody else. And that book is, I think, is like a must-read book. And in the foreword, that's when I posed this question, but I gave, and he gives the answer of how did it happen? How did the pilgrims who were in charge, and they came to be in charge as a result of crimes against, huge crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, human trafficking, all of that, and then they lose their own, you know, they lose the country that they built. How does that happen?
Oh, you're picking up there, yeah. Okay, you're back.
Oh, and so he answered.
Yeah, I kind of cut off your last part of that of what you were saying. You were talking about the crimes that were committed by the I guess you were saying the international Zionist community.
I'm not talking about the international Zionist community. I'm talking about the pilgrims and their descendants here in the United States, who committed genocide, crimes against humanity, in order to seize this land that we call the United States of America and build a country out of this land that they seized. That's who I'm talking about. And those are the people who have been totally, their descendants, totally hoodwinked, or they chose to join with the Ziocons and turn the country over. So this is the situation that we have, and it's only if through unity, I believe, that we will be able, and we be able to take our country back. And so now there are some Trump supporters, the staunch Trump supporters, the ones who sound like Black people sounded during Barack Obama's days. Now I see these people sound just like that. It's like they drank the Kool-Aid, right? And so they can't see, but those people are not going to be able to do it by themselves. They're going to have the unity of Blacks, Latinos, everybody else who calls themselves a citizen, a proud citizen of the United States of America, and wants the United States to represent good in the world and to treat the people inside our borders with dignity and respect, and to treat those outside our borders with dignity and respect. I want the United States to be a beacon for the world of hope and of good things. I want, for example, the investment. I don't want a single, you know, we've got veterans this winter right now freezing to death. Veterans. I just posted it on my Facebook page. I think he was in Ohio. Released from the Veterans Administration. He was in the hospital, released from the hospital, and he froze to death at the bus stop. We've got this woman who was turned out of the hospital because that's what hospitals these days do, and the people have accepted it because it wasn't their problem. They had jobs. They didn't care about what was happening in the Black community and the brown community. Didn't care. Were silent. Now it's happening to them. I give the example of heinous police acts, the vaginal swabs, the cavity searches. That was just done to Black men. Now it's done to white, blonde, blue-eyed white women having vaginal swabs. This is ridiculous. Absolutely, totally ridiculous. And so I just continue to believe that it's up to all of us to join together and stop this madness. And if we don't, then the madness will descend on the United States, period.
Yes, I agree. Is that that's what we've seen a lot of is that it's like what you were talking about earlier, is that the a lot of the foreign things that the United States used to do, a lot of the things that we used to do overseas have came back to the United States, and now people are starting to realize how heinous some of these actions were. You know, one of the ideas that came to mind, the indefinite detention centers that we used to have, you know, and all across the Middle East, and we did for many years. Now, just recently, it's starting to come to light that we've been doing this in, you know, Chicago. There was that there was pretty much that black site that they had up there where there were, you know, that was exposed about 2 years ago. And that's kind of like,
I remember
the CIA's involved, you know, one of the CIA's, like, you know, one of the most common actions over the Middle East coming back to the United States. You know, the next thing is, I can imagine, it is going to be, you know, probably like they have over there, or, well, yeah, well, they have over there, they have here, is that, you know, indefinite, you know, permanent indefinite detention, where people are going to camps that are determined to be threats. And what will be determined as a threat is going to be very up to decision by law enforcement of different levels. It's not just going to be people that are actually actively trying to do a terrorist attack or stated that, but people that and they've done it in different ways before too, with just our legal system. But I could see it in large numbers of people just with, you know, strong political beliefs, and eventually we'll just have what I believe will be re-education camps of some nature in the United States. We'll have at some point too. It'll be. I could see it happening. Besides, we already have the militarized police force, but we could have. I could see actual military of some kind. Maybe not our military. Maybe United Nations on our streets patrolling in certain areas, and it might become more widespread. I'm a believer truly in the idea that we have our government, and because it's in the bills, it's in the legislation, that our government has been planning to lock this country down for a long time in just a total state of martial law. You know, FEMA camps, the whole nine yards. If you know, fusion centers have already became a thing, and that was one of the first steps to it. You look at Rex 84, and that was the first that was started.
That's
camp,
right.
All with ICE
that's
and everything.
Right.
So it's stuff that's already started, it's already in motion, it's already on the books. And, you know, people will look at you like you're crazy when you mention the term FEMA camp. But all you should mention is, hey, look at Rex 84, look what ICE has done in the past. Now, if you believe they're only going to do that to them, they're only going to do that to immigrants, you're wrong. They're going to do that to you one day, because that's how it always is, that they'll do, look in the 30s, in the 40s, what they used to do to what the government did to black men.
That's right.
And everything. Now that's been generalized to all branches of the military, where these, pretty much, look at the Gulf War. That was like the biggest experiment ever, is that all these people came home sick after, you know, it's like, oh, we'll just, you know, drop bombs on Saddam's chemical weapons stash, see what that does to the soldiers, you know, is that at this point, everyone's disposable, everyone's expendable, and it's going to keep going that direction. It used to be just, like you said, more of the minority groups, and the average white man of America did not see it so much because it didn't really affect them directly. Now everybody's being affected, and foreign, you know, overseas, and our Chile and the different allied governments. They used to do all the stuff that we talked about, you know, at the sponsorship of the CIA. They took people away in black vans in the middle of the night. They killed the leftist dissidents all across South America for 3 decades. You know, more than 3 decades, really, but that was the height of it, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. Like Andres Perez in Venezuela, but they love to talk about Hugo Chavez, but they never talk about who was before him. Andres Perez in Venezuela, you had Alfredo Stroessner in Paraguay, you had the dictatorship, the Argentinian dictatorship. And so on and so on. They disappeared. And now I could see these kind of same tactics that, like, Pinochet did in Chile, are starting to come to the United States. And
that's right. That's right. That's scary.
It is scary. It is. And that's the thing, is that it is the chain of how it works, is that it goes from third world country to the base country. Our allies do it first, and then we do it ourselves at home. It's kind of like our allies almost like a testing, I think, sometimes, is of some of these programs. Like a lot of the, I would say the surveillance and militarization programs of the police and such were tested in Latin America. And you look at some of the mentality of some people that are, strong law enforcement defenders, that believe the law enforcement can't do anything wrong, or the people that really truly believe in this idea that the government is trying to, should be used as a weapon to stifle the opposite side of politics. I mean, just look at that. There's a good portion of this country, not a good portion of this country, but there's a good portion of this country that probably would support, Pinochet-type tactics in our country. And there's a small portion on the internet that actually likes Pinochet. I mean, you see these people talk about dropping helicopters. Something went terribly wrong, but when the hilarious thing is some of these people that like Pinochet, they actually believe he was some kind of some person that fought globalism or something like that when he was literally brought in by Kissinger, Nixon. But that's
right, exactly.
That's irrelevant at this point. I got another question before the, I don't know how much longer you're going to stay. You said you'd be 1 hour or so, but.
Yeah, which is about now. But anyway, go ahead with your question.
Last question is, are you considering doing any more political campaigns in the future? Or is that something that you have in mind?
Oh, well, that's always in the back of my mind, and it's just a matter of the making it a physical possibility. And so far, that's been the problem because, of course, running in a campaign takes a whole lot of money. I would also be happy to support someone else who was ready to do that. So, and I've got a couple of offers, but I have to think a little bit harder about that.
Yeah, I understand. So, anyway. It's a very consuming process. Any kind of campaign. You have to use up all your time, because I've interviewed multiple candidates in different races, and it seems like for them it was a it's very hard if you got anything else to do, for somebody of a normal person that has to go to work,
it's
very hard
to get
involved with the political process.
Yeah. So, and I have to work for a living. So, with that having been said, I can't stop working. In the past, my mom and dad were able to, when they were younger and I was too, they were able to finance my campaign, but that's not possible now. So it's a different financial reality for me. So that's, that's fine. But although I understand that I don't need as much as the more the whole system gets discredited, the more I get questions like that. So we'll just see. I don't rule anything out, and I say anything is possible.
I think it's a little bit, maybe it's we don't truly believe it, just a little bit of hope that maybe we consider some kind of run for something. Because right now, Congress, the entire D.C., it's looking pretty bleak. I mean, the last person that I admired at all, really, in Washington, D.C., left 4 or 5 years ago. That was been almost 5 years since he left officially. Ron Paul left in January 2013. And that was probably the last person that I actually liked in Washington, D.C. altogether. I mean, people all the time throw out different names of who's supposed to be next, the anti-establishment person. I mean, I do admire what Tulsi Gabbard did with the whole Syria, exposing what was wrong with Syria.
Been, Yeah, that would have been Ron Paul, because everybody else today has gone along with something. And, you know, they throw out Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth Warren is not, you know, she voted for every one of the wars. Okay, let's go to Bernie. Bernie has voted for every one of the wars prior to 2016. So Bernie did do a lot of growing during the campaign, but still, at the end of the day, he endorsed Hillary. That is an automatic out for me. No way. You endorsed Hillary. That means you, at the end of the day, you support that agenda. And there's no way I can support that agenda. Same with Elizabeth Warren. Then you go to Tulsi. Okay, so Tulsi spoke out. Yes, she did. But then when the crucial votes for war came, she voted. So, you know, what's going on with Tulsi? She there was there were a couple of pro-Israel votes, and I can't remember them now. But I was watching, and Tulsi voted yes. So I said, okay, that rules her out, because I know when that saying, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. Well, she got going in the wrong direction. So that ruled Tulsi out. So now who else is there? What I learned and what I opened up with my book is that it's all political theory, theater. It's just political theater. Anybody who got into Congress with the support of the political party that they ran under is not going to buck that support for anything. It's just, and anything else is just theater. So we need to sweep the Congress clean. That's something we have to do. And we need to, there's a lawsuit that's been filed in Georgia, and then I'll close on this. There's a lawsuit that's been filed in Georgia that would make it easier. The Libertarians filed the lawsuit to make it easier for members of what are called minor parties to run in congressional seats and get on the ballot. We need ballot access. That's the biggest source of election fraud, not voter fraud, election fraud, is the way independent political parties are treated in the system. The system is rigged. And I'm looking very closely at that lawsuit by the Libertarians, because leveling the playing field somewhat by giving ballot access is a huge step forward to us being able to recruit candidates to run in these independent political parties, and then in that way, take the country back.
That's very hopefully that goes well for the Libertarians of Georgia and all the people that aspire to see a some kind of force. It's not the Democrats and Republicans in the Georgia. You know, this is one of those also symbolic things that that might be a turning of the tide. I had one more thing I wanted to ask is that I read, is that we didn't even mention much about your experiences on the – I don't think we even mentioned at all about your experiences on the – I don't know if it was called flotillas, but the two voyages into the Gaza Sea. You were arrested by the Israeli government for – what was the amount of time you were arrested for?
I spent 1 week I spent 7 days in an Israeli prison, and that was because the Israelis kidnapped us and took us to Israel. There was no intention of ever going to Israel. We didn't even come close to Israel. We were going to Gaza, but the Israelis kidnapped us. So, there's enough. there's enough in that story for a whole nother book. I did write Ain't Nothing Like Freedom. I wrote a little bit about that. I also have another book to my credit, The Illegal War in Libya, where my relationship with the Libyans began because they saw this, who is this woman who's doing all of this just to try and get with the Palestinians. And so then they invited me to come and learn about their system of governance. And of course, you know, I teach political science, so this was really quite helpful to me. And anyway, so that's a whole nother discussion that we can have. But when the revolution comes and we are able to take back our country, what kind of system of governance do we want? And certainly I think that there are some deficiencies that we have seen in the republic, which is an indirect democracy, and so therefore maybe it's time for us to go to direct democracy. I just throw that out, and then we can discuss that later. But this has been great in terms of an introduction, and I also would like people to watch me on Facebook. My Facebook page is Cynthia McKinney Official, and on Twitter, I'm Cynthia McKinney. And I have a website. That website is allthingscynthiamckinney.com. So check me out and go to the website and do the contact us and send me a note if you're interested in anything that I've had to say tonight.
It's been great having you on the show tonight, Cynthia. And yeah, hopefully we have a follow-up show at some point. It'd be great because I feel like there was a lot of stuff that could have delved into. That, you know, it's like, I only got to ask a couple questions, but the way that all the stuff that you mentioned and the conversation I had, it was a great conversation. Definitely all my followers, all the people that listen to the show, definitely check out her Facebook, Twitter, or website. You definitely, if you're looking for a good place for real news, she'll deliver.
Yeah. Thank you.
Was that your official sign off, or was that some kind of sound effect? I mean, I thought I'd be the one that'd be pushing any kind of sound effect ones. I'm the host here. Anyways, this is Chris. Still remain on the show. We still got our last two in. We still got our remaining hour and a. No, only 45 minutes left, actually. I don't know what I was about to say, and the show. So to everybody that's still listening, anybody that wants to call in as well, to have a little bit of discussion on the interview that we just did, I did say call in, we're welcome. That would be cool, and it would be great to get a few more voices into this conversation tonight. By the way, that call-in number is going to be 845-277-9223, 845-277-9223, here at Voice of Rebellion Radio. On Stable Radio Live here, it is getting close to the midnight mark on the East Coast, and it will be about 9 o'clock on the Pacific time. So we're going to stay on the air probably about till 12:30-ish. After that, probably will be dropping off. By the way, this will be restreamed onto UCY.TV, which is the official home of Voice of Rebellion Radio with Chris J. And it'll be also probably on a few other platforms, definitely on YouTube, where you can check out all of UCY.TV shows. We have also UCY.TV archive if you're listening to this rebroadcast on Sunday night. If you missed part of the show and just tuned in or tuned in late, you can go to the archives later and listen to the entire show. And that call-in number one more time is going to be 845-277-9223, 845-277-9223, Hear Voice Run Radio. Please, if you are listening to the show, please go to the this time. Make sure that you put the effort, go to YouTube, give us a like. Even if you already listen to the show, maybe just go to the YouTube page just to get the views. You know, this is a way to boost UCY.TV's name, Voice of Rebellion Radio's name. It really helps this brand, really helps all of us here at UCY.TV. And, it's more recognition, more people listen to our show. This is a good thing. So please do that if you can. I just want to cap the show off with talking about a little bit more, about the political system as it is today. And, you know, she was starting to delve into Libya and the direct democracy. And, you know, we're talking about the Green Book and stuff of that nature when it comes to Libya's governmental system. Is that, to me, this is a Gaddafi was a visionary with political ideals that, you know, they were deemed insane to the West. But here in the United States, here in the United States is that we have ultimately they call it a democracy, but it's a oligarchy. And I wouldn't even say it's an oligarchy in disguise. It's definitely an oligarchy where we have, like since you kept saying, we are not even ownership. Our people are the people that are currently in control of America nowadays. We've been hijacked by the international bankers, and our will is no longer shown by the internet. Is shown by America's government. America's government is now dictated by the top lobbies, by the bankers, and all the people the powers that be that right now, I would say that our president is no more than a figurehead for all the people that are truly in power. And this puppet show they were watching at the top when it comes to this whole fallout in Washington, D.C., is very evident of that. You know, we have Trump and, you know, the supposed fallout with the deep state. But in reality, like Cynthia was saying, is that the two sides are colliding between, you know, they control both sides, the Democrats, Republicans, whatever you want to call them, the Zio-cons versus the Zio-liberals. Both sides are controlled by the Zionists. And the United States government is currently 100% paid and bought for by the Israeli government, by the United States bank, or by the bankers overseas, etc. You know, is that we got in all these wars that have absolutely no meaning to American people. There's no reason why we need to go to Iraq. There's no reason why we need to go to Afghanistan. Why did we do such things? You know, on behalf of the bankers. Now, right now we're looking at, you know, how the United States government, you know, they talk about how they're the force of peace. And one of the prime examples of how they've not been a force of peace is that ultimately, despite all the pushing on by the United States government, you know, their ideas of immediately intervention against North Korea, is that we see the North Korea and South Korea seems to be almost working itself together more than with any help. You know, right now we have South Korea and North Korea making a joint Olympic team. You know, this is a very rare show of unity. And that is definitely not by the help of the United States government. Now, I feel that the Olympics has there might have been a one upside to the Olympics, but there's been a lot of downsides, of course. Like, I think the political banning of Russia from the game was a complete joke. While they were talking about steroids, well, you know, probably many Olympic teams committed violations when it came to performance-enhancing drugs. I feel like that was just a way a political ploy in order to put pressure on Russia. And, you know, if we're looking at also talk about more pressure onto North Korea by the United States government, it looks like Tillerson was just pushing, just like how he started his term, is that he was pushing sanctions against Venezuela, now he's pushing sanctions against North Korea. This is just in the news on RT. And, you know, this is the funny thing is that people that talk about how they how RT is 100% in favor of the Trump administration. You know, they're criticizing one of the top Trump officials. You know, look here in – let's see, what else was looking at in the news? That's pretty much what I'm just going through. Just ran about the news. I think it's quite a bit better. You know, they're not perfect RT, but – they are, you know, when it comes to the biggest news source that I actually trust, maybe in the world, might be RT, because I don't trust BBC. I don't trust Al Jazeera. I don't trust MSNBC, CNN, Fox. Don't trust France 24. Don't trust really any Western, major Western media, Sky News, Guardian, The Sun, The Mirror, The Express. You know, I started just going with all these different UK papers. Oh, my God, they're just ridiculous. Now, looking at the news that I saw, it is a funny comment made by Vladimir Zhirinovsky in Russia, who's ran for president probably more about as many times as people have fingers. I mean, I think he's ran about 10 times for president. He is saying if the United States actually claims that Russia meddled in the election, they should meddle in our election to make me win. It's kind of I think that the Vladimir Zhirinovsky is kind of a tool for the West, as his party is known to be pro-Israel. You know, it's a very strong. He claims to be a very strong nationalist, even though that his party's pro-Israel. When even the government of Russia is not pro-Israel. Putin's not really been known to be a friend of Israel. And again, I think the Communist Party of Russia, I'm not sure what their stance is on Israel. I was about to say Gennady Zyuganov as their candidate, but that's not their candidate. This time, I think it's Pavel Grudinin, I think is the candidate's name, that is running this time. Let's see. I mentioned, it's Grudinin is the president's running this time, or candidate's running this time in Russia. Just want to see. I want to see if anything comes up. If I put in Pavel Grudinin in Israel, it'd be interesting. This is like an out of the blue candidate that came in. Some people are saying he might have a chance in the election. Vladimir Zhirinovsky claims they're just claims because he just says whatever. Because that he could potentially win. Apparently, Grudinin is probably, I guess, is the number two candidate. Zyuganov was last time the number two candidate. Last time, but according to polls, I think that Putin's going to win, I think, in the first round, potentially, even though there's some people that say they might go to the second round, which in that case, maybe something weird could happen. The Russian elections are coming soon. They're only in March, and we're already, it's getting towards the latter part of January. This could be a very interesting election, if that's the case. If we have, let's see, Putin may win. This is what the RT article that was posted earlier today. Current Russian President Vladimir Putin may win the upcoming presidential election in the first round. A survey by the Russian Public Opinion Research Center and says that the current president would receive 81.1% of the vote. Wow. And that would surpass his former, his last time he only had about 59% of the vote, and the Communist Party candidate Pavel Grudinin will receive 7.6% of the vote. So this is like the number. This is a 1 point. There was a little bit more hype about him before. I mean, maybe RT would be downplaying maybe the top opponent to Putin. That could be a possibility. Zhirinovsky 4.2%, and then there's the Socialite. This I think what Putin said was like the joke of the party. Ksenia Sobchak, of I believe that's how you pronounce the name, of the Civil Initiative Party of she's under, I think, perhaps less than 1% right now. And there's probably, so it's almost like certain that Putin's going to win this election then. See what comes up. I'm just out of curiosity. See what comes up if anything. I want to put in Pavel Grudinin, Israel. Let's see. I want to see what this article. The closest thing I think they're saying is the change of guard. It's a little bit different too. Grudinin's like a former. Have a major farm. Apparently, he's got these strong communist ideals. It says the leader of the Russian communists have proposed the head of a major agricultural enterprise, Pavel Grudinin, as the party's candidate for the 2018 presidential poll. Seems goes into the background. Zayanov has confirmed that the party leaders were actively discussing the possible nomination of Grudinin as candidate, but also asked reporters to stop inventing theories before a final decision is made by a secret vote at the elections committee. Grudinin, in the longtime director of a large and successful agriculture enterprise in suburban Moscow, companies named Lenin, Sokolkos, mimics the Soviet era word, described as state run farms, but in reality, it's a close partnership. Let's see. Grudinin is not a member of the Russian Communist Party, but described himself as its supporter. Russian law allows political parties before candidates that are not members. At the same time, in November this year, Zaganov announced that all the regional branches of the Communist Party supported his 2018 bid for the presidency again, adding that the final decision had to be confirmed at the election committee. On Friday afternoon, the presidium of the Communist Party's General Committee recommended the proposed Grudinin as a candidate for the presidential elections. RBC News site quoted an unnamed source in the party as saying that the probability that the Saturday convention would heed the presidium's recommendation was high. Well, maybe just a nobody candidate in that case, because it's only got 7% and kind of came out of nowhere. Let's see. I think they're just the only mentions of when I came up was just talk about like a comparison between that and like kibbutzes between his farms. Let's see. I do find it very interesting about about this election in particular. There is like I wonder because with all the hate towards Russia, would the United States government maybe try to do something to interfere in their election if possible? And maybe but it doesn't seem to be a possibility with the amount of how strong the support for Vladimir Putin is in Russia. It's an unbreakable bond.